All right, thank you very much. Just as a, for my interest before I start giving it, how many people here have a background in quantum optics or photonics at all? Hands up if you do. Okay, so for those people, you're going to see a lot of stuff you already know. Enjoy it. For everybody else, let's ask questions. All right, so this is work done, obviously, in Australia. This is meant to be really informal, so I know I'm giving talk slides, but feel absolutely free to interrupt with questions, please, if you have them.
This is in Canberra.
This is in Brisbane, in Australia, which so it's about halfway up on the east coast. Canberra is not far; it's about 1600 k away. All right. So my lab does four areas of research. One is on kind of quantum simulation and emulation, and I will talk more about what we mean by those terms later. Another thing which I'm not going to talk about today, but I'm happy to talk about, to people about afterwards, is quantum foundations. Testing reality, the wave function, and things like that. The third area where we have a long-standing interest is quantum computation. And then the fourth area is quantum photonics. And this is building the tools so we can make progress in the other three, because unfortunately we can't buy off the shelf the kind of things we'd like to have to do the kind of investigations we'd like to do. So today I'm going to be talking to you mostly about stuff in the simulation and emulation space. But to talk about that, and I'm aware of my audience, I'm going to have to talk about some of the experimental tools, so bear with me. And then some new stuff as well. You're getting to see me, but of course there's a team of experimentalists and theorists from all over the world. It's normally pretty happy, except around World Cup time. Last year was quite fun, in that the German and the Brazilian were in the same office. And when the Brazilian came in that morning, it was covered in German flags. Right, simulating quantum systems begins with, as with so many things, back with Richard Feynman. He wrote this paper back in 82 where he said, look, the real problem with simulating quantum mechanics is perhaps the computation. We know exactly what we need to do. We just need to solve Schrodinger's equation. And of course, the number of equations blows up exponentially with the number of particles. And it's just hopeless if you're using kind of classical computation models. And he said, if you think about that, that's really strange, because nature herself has no problem efficiently doing quantum systems. So maybe the issue is not nature, maybe the issue is we're using the wrong computational building blocks. The paper is freely available as a PDF on the web, and go download it and read it if you haven't. It's a weird mix of ahead of its time and really old-fashioned. But one of the things I liked so much about it is it's full of these sketches of these wiggly lines of photons and calcite crystals. And you can see Feynman has no clue how a calcite crystal works, but it's okay. But since this is what we do in our lab, it's quite nice to see. When you read the paper, if you've read it, it's not clear whether Feynman's talking about an emulator or a simulator. So what do I mean by the difference between those two things? So there's lots of other fields of physics and engineering where you want to solve a hard problem, and you can take two approaches. And so just say you're from Australia and you'd like to fly anywhere in the world in 4 hours as opposed to, say, 24 hours. You'd like a scramjet engine. Scramjet engines are hard to build, so people try and build. This is an emulator at the University of Queensland. It's tens of meters of long. It takes real engineers to build it, and it's a physical device. You put in it something like this round object here, and you do a physical measurement that gives you a physical quantity. So in this case, you're putting a flow around it, and you take a very quick photo using something called a holographic interferogram, and from that you pull out. This is the density of the flow, this is the electron concentration of the flow. And you try and tell something about the system under test. But if you see something unexpected, oh, I wasn't expecting the electrons to be that far from the surface, or I wasn't expecting the angle like that, is that a new phenomenon that you have to cope with, or is it just due to the way that you've built the emulator? Maybe the walls of the tank were too close, or maybe you're getting electrostatic interactions. So you also build a simulator, which is a digital model to give you the physical quantity. And in this case, you can see there's good agreement between the simulation and emulation. And it's those two things working back off of each other, the emulation, the simulation, that gives you some confidence that you understand the problem. And that's true in any field of experimental endeavor, and it's certainly going to be true with quantum problems as well. The advantage of the digital model is you've got error correction. There's no error correction for the emulator, so you've got a verification issue. there's kind of still a verification issue with the digital model as well, in that you've picked some Hamiltonian. Did you pick the right Hamiltonian that actually describes the system? So you need this feedback between the two things. And the same is true in the quantum case. It's known in the quantum case that for a quantum simulator, there's a scalability advantage. You get at least an exponential advantage, if not more, over the best known classical approaches. It's not entirely clear if that's true for the emulators.
Sorry, can I ask a question to clarify?
Sure, so, please do.
So where here would I put, say, an analog computer?
That's a really good question. So an analog computer, of course, is neither of these things. Here I'm trying to simulate some existing problem. Now, I might use an analog computer as the emulator, right? But of course, I have no error correction, which is why analog computers had such a bad rap, right? And it's why, of course, in the early days of quantum computers, too, when I was in my 20s and a PhD student, there are older physicists in my department who are like, our quantum computers are complete nonsense. They're analog computers, and we know the errors are unbounded and run away. So that's why that error correction is so important. But it's a good question. We'll come back to it. Because what do we mean by quantum when we're talking about these systems? So here's one of my favorite things from undergraduate, which was Zitterbewegung. I really liked it just because I couldn't say it. And it's trembling motion of a relativistic electron. So what I love about it, too, is Dirac-Rödy's... Sorry, wrong one. Just look where the dots are. Dirac-Rödy's equation in 1930. And Schrödinger looked at it and then very quickly realized that the following would happen, that as an electron here transiting from the left to the right moved along, it would be shaking or trembling. And it would do so at a fairly high frequency, 10 to the 21 hertz, and a fairly small amplitude, 10 to the minus 12 meters. So it's never been observed. It's way outside of the observable regime. But it has been simulated in quantum systems. When people realize that the non-relativistic Schrödinger equation can have the same form as the Dirac equation. And it's really easy to do the non-relativistic Schrödinger equation in the lab. There's a lot of different platforms. So this is a paper from Rainer Blatt's group in 2010. And they took an iron trap. For those of you who aren't used to iron traps, that's a 1 euro coin. That's about the size of the trap. When you zoom up in the middle, we have these are three trapped calcium ions. And you just need one calcium ion. And then you look at its motion. And this wiggling that you see here, this is the Zitterbewegung under different conditions. And they got a paper in Nature on that, which is very nice. At the same time, there was an experiment done by another group in Germany, Alex Zamiat's group, who took a series of waveguides from different refractive indices. A is slightly higher refractive index than B, and they also saw this motion. This is the, that's the theory, that's the experiment, and if you can see these dark stripes here, that's the Bewegung, that's the trembling motion there. The really high frequency stuff is just experimental error. That was a classical simulation because they just used a classical laser beam and normal square wave, square law detectors. But if they'd replaced the square law detectors with photon counters, then suddenly it would have been a quantum simulation and they would have seen exactly the same results. And then finishing it up, in 2013, there was again another observation of Zitterbewegung with the Bose-Einstein condensate. So with the ion trap and particularly with the Bose-Einstein condensate, it seems a really quantum-y thing to do. If you're using it with a laser pointer like this and a detector you can buy from Thor Labs for $100, it doesn't seem a very quantum thing to do. So this is a single quanta effect, and they always are more surprising if you're investigating them in a system that has no classical counterpart. But the modeled physics is the same, whether you're doing it with a $10 laser or a, you know, a BEC setup that costs $150,000. So the question when you're doing these things is, what is of interest? Is it the physics of the phenomena, which you can study more easily with one system than another? Or is it the physics of the simulators or emulators? Or is it some combination of those two things? So these are just questions to keep in mind. I liked all of those experiments. But you know, all of them you could have easily have done on MATLAB, right? So, and in fact, they were all quantum walks, which is the quantum analog of random walks. 10 years ago, these were all known as quantum random walks, and in fact, one of the really good earlier review papers by Julia Kemper in Contemporary Physics is called Quantum Random Walks. But the editor of that journal, Peter Knight, pointed out that quantum random walks are neither quantum nor random. So the name got changed a little bit. Experimentally, these can now be done with very high precision and accuracy. So this is some waveguides in a piece of glass. There's three waveguides coming in, zoomed up region. The waveguides are close enough that the light can just hop across, and you can see this tunneling with the interference effects, and then the waveguides are pulled apart so you can measure the light going through.
Which equation does it satisfy when you show the smooth curve? It's a solution of some equation. Which equation is this?
Probably the non-relativistic Schrodinger equation.
But what is the quantity? Is the electric field? These are basically classical optics equations, and they are solved in the paraxial approximation.
So the smooth curves being these smooth curves here?
Yes.
This is Grosskopf with the Grosskopf equation.
I think so, yeah.
Well, it means, how would it go? It means the Grosskopf equation. What is the quantity that is plotted? The electric field or what?
I think it's the position with time. It's the degree of trembling or something like that.
The position of what?
Oh, this is meant to be modeling the electron. So this is, so perhaps it's...
Electron, well, what is translated? It is glass. It's the electric material.
No, but remember...
What is that?
So remember, all of this is just meant to be modeling this idea. So there's some amplitude that changes with time, and there's some degree of ripple.
So the waveguides, but you have real waveguides. Of what are they made?
Oh, they're made of glass.
Okay.
Different refractive indices glass. And then it's the difference with the, as you go along that waveguide, good.
So what's the potential in this equation?
So the potential is something like, sorry, I had that, something like this.
No, it's the effective thickness of the waveguide. It's actually the electric field.
It's the thickness. So that's basically, if I understand correctly, what the theory solves is the Maxwell's equation. You solve the Maxwell's equation, and that's the density of photons.
Yeah, right? But then they showed some experiments also with the Bose-Einstein condensate. So
okay,
that's
what I'm trying to understand each of them. So in one case, it's basically a classical wave, and then it is... Then you have to use the paraxial approximation, because otherwise there are no the z direction plays the role of time.
Actually, you don't in fact have to use the paraxial approximation in these waveguides, in that you can have longitudinal polarization, which doesn't exist in the paraxial approximation. But it is.
That's fine. But is there, what plays the role of time?
So the role of time is played by the where you are on the waveguide. So these various things are taken as various slices.
And the theta value is of the photons. Yes.
Well, it's not really theta value of the photons. It's modeling a single electron. So in all three cases,
I thought that it is a dielectric material.
No, remember, it's modeling an electron, right?
It's modeling, but it's an experiment.
Yes. So you measure utterly different things in experiments. In this one, you measure intensity of light,
intensity of light is the strength of the electric field, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And the reason, and this equation, what you do is you work in a regime where the Maxwell equation are well approximated by a Schrödinger equation, but what plays the role of the electric wave function is the electric field. Is this correct? Do I understand you correctly?
Yeah.
Well, the Helmholtz equation.
Which one?
Helmholtz equation.
The Helmholtz equation. Yeah. This is correct, but I think it's a special case where if you want the z direction to play the role of time, you need to make the paraxial approximation.
It's done in this simulation.
Okay. And then you say there is also a waveguide with the Grosskopf-Pitayevsky equation. And that's Hopfner regime where the Grosskopf-Pitayevsky equation is applicable.
So in all these cases, of course, you've got underlying different physical phenomena, and in all of them you're trying to simulate the same equation, which is the one that describes the Zeta Pythagorean.
Okay, so then you have a situation where the Grosskopf-Pitayevsky equation is applicable.
That would be certainly in this case,
is this the light?
No, that is, let's see.
At least that's
cold atoms. They're cold atoms, so that would be the position of the cold atom. measured as a function of time.
Yes,
so why is it? But you can still image the condensate at the end.
You imagine, you are sure that you have the condensate. So that's basically, the technique is imaging.
Yes, yeah. So, I mean, in the end, of course, regardless of the experiment, we've got to pull some information out somehow, right? You've got to get some probability distribution. And whether it's the ions in space, or it's the density of the atoms, or the intensity of the light, they all map back then to the thing you're trying to emulate. What's interesting about this, of course, is that this is really not an interesting problem to emulate. It's a single quantum problem. It's, you can do it efficiently in MATLAB or Mathematica. So we'll get to where it gets interesting, hopefully later. So with the quantum walks, again, if they're single quantum problems, they're not terribly surprising. But once you start allowing multiple quanta, then different things happen. So for example, if I have two photons come in at different times, then the kind of, this is a correlation which is just meant to be, just look at the pretty colors. Okay. This is what you would get with classical light, but if the two photons came at the same time, you get a very different thing, and you get these interferences that don't occur.
So the two photons are initially in a correlated state?
No, they can be from different photon sources. They just have to be indistinguishable. And so that's non-classical interference. And then we'll talk a lot more about that. Just in terms of the technology, that's a linear line. We have also done a circular array, so you have access to all the inputs and outputs, and you can have periodic boundary conditions. And you can vary the coupling. In this case, we vary the couplings by making it elliptical as opposed to circular. And again, you can see difference between classes.
So basically, you create a correlation via post-selection, like, for instance, then when teleportation protocols, basically.
So no, this is this.
You measure the coincidence in output pores, and then if you measure that, you know that.
Yeah. So it's not so much on post-selection as on when you see two photons.
Yeah.
You're looking at the correlations between those two photons that you see.
Oh yeah, there are no non-linearity in the system. So.
There's no non-linearity. This is all just glass. In the linear regime with single photons.
Excuse me, can you explain what you mean by quantum walks?
Yes. Yeah, okay. So, I had slides on this. Okay, so a quantum walk is basically the idea that I have a walker and I have a coin, and what the walker is going to do depends on the coin. But the coin now can be a quantum object. So instead of being heads or tails, it can be in a superposition of heads and tails. So normally on a random walk, I'll go heads, I'll go that way, heads, I'll go that way, tails, I'll go this way. On a quantum walk, I can go, oh, I've got a superposition of heads and tails, so I'll go left and right simultaneously. Then I flip the coin again, I might have a different superposition of heads and tails. I'll go left and right simultaneously, but with different phases. And so I build up a kind of a wave function.
Isn't it just a visual Schrödinger equation? In a discrete time.
You can do discrete time quantum walks, or you can do continuous time quantum walks.
So this is the analogy is like Schrödinger equation in a spin orbit, because you have the discrete degrees of freedom, which is the coin, and then depending on the spin, you correlate to the momentum. So the analogy is with the.
And there is some external. Force which switches off on spins. Or
so what is this coin boss?
Yeah, that's also it. So you have spin speed, right?
So there's lots of different ways you can do it. One way you can do it with a single photon is you can make the polarization of the single photon the thing that decides whether it goes left or right at a polarizing beam splitter. If you're doing it with spins, which has also been done, then it can be the magnetic field. Mexico, left or right. So
but Knight here was referring to the single photon. Now maybe you should comment because.
Yeah, that's why I brought the photo back up. So the reason this. The reason that I put this joke in, Peter said it's neither quantum nor random because you can do it all classically with classical waves. Okay? You can have water waves coming in to disturbances and get exactly the same behavior. So for a single quanta effect, I mean, for any single quanta effect, you can always find a classical analog. They're really not surprising.
If it's a boson,
if it's a boson. I'm a photon person. Fermions don't exist so much for me. For any single boson effect, there's nothing surprising. So that's why Peter was saying quantum random walks, as they were being talked about 13 years ago, were neither quantum nor random, because you could get exactly the same behaviours with ropes or water waves or any other wave system. As we shall see, that's no longer true.
So this experiment you've shown, it's quantum, but still not random, right?
Yeah, it's still not random because you know exactly, I mean, the only random part is, you know, where will you see a photon, and that's the normal randomness of quantum mechanics. But the output of the wave function is exactly well known what it will be. So,
what is the reason to put it in a circle?
Just for something different. So with the straight line, of course, you walk out and then you stop. So with the circle, you can do repeated walks around the circle and see if you can build up effects with time, see collapse and revival and things like this. We were just playing, basically. There is another reason, and I'll get to it. So let's go to quantum emulators. So quantum biology are not two words that you normally hear together. The first person to put them together was Schrödinger in these lectures in 43, What is Life? Again, they're available online, PDF, easy to download. And he said, look, the only quantum aspect to life are the chemical bonds. And he ruled out quantum tunneling and quantum coherence as playing any role in life in cells, except he has a little footnote, well, maybe enhancing mutation rates, but there really is no quantum aspects to life. And so certainly if you go to most physicists 10 years ago, and even most physicists today, and say, what do you think of quantum biology? Visually, you'll get this kind of answer. I gave this slide in Vienna, by the way, and I was really happy with the juxtaposition. Okay. If you go to a biologist and you say, what do you think of quantum physics? And I've done this, the answer you get is maths is hard. And that's not just a cheap joke at biologists. There's this great paper in PNAS from 2012. They did a study of 10 years of biology literature, and they found that biology papers receive 28% fewer citations for every additional equation per page in the main text. Now, I'm talking to theorists. I want you to think about what that would mean for your citations, right? No one would ever read your papers. So there's a language problem between the...
cite the paper doesn't mean that you read the paper.
Well, okay. But it's at least I hope you might have skimmed it. Right. So, quantum biology looks like really not much there, except if you dig back in the literature, a long way back, even back in 63, there's this paper in Nature where they say, look, there is a quantum coherent effect in vision, in fact, in your eyeballs, where you have some molecule, it gets excited by stimulated emission, and then it goes through this avoided crossing, and if that process was incoherent, half the time it would go back here, and half the time it would go here, but because it's coherent, it always occurs here. And you've got near 100% efficiency for low light levels in the eye. And that can only be if it's coherent. And that's kind of interesting because it's a large molecule, it's a warm, wet system, and you're in a quantum coherent kind of regime. Yep?
Just clarify, is it coherence induced from the outside, or what you're saying is that you need to take into account coherence in order to explain the dynamics?
That's right. There's no way for this trajectory to occur unless at this point there's coherent behavior going on with the molecule. And so that was a really early paper, 63. And you look at the data, it's terrible. It's a Polaroid of an oscilloscope. There's one kind of dip. But it's been followed up, and there's a follow-up paper in 2010 just confirming it with much more modern measurements. This is exactly what's going on. So there is a quantum coherent effect in vision.
So it looks like a tunneling event. So what kind of
expansion?
So yeah, let's see. The first thing that happens is you've got a stimulated emission into the cis form of rhodopsin. Then you go through this conical intersection, and you turn into the trans form. And if that wasn't coherent, then about half the time you'd fall back down and stay in the cis form. And you need the trans form to be active in the vision.
Isomerization, some sort of geometrical isomerization coordinate.
I don't know. It's the honest answer, I don't know. Then if you look back through the literature in 66, they said, look, there's evidence of electron tunneling and photosynthesis, hydrogen tunneling and enzymes in 89. Most famously, a few years ago, particularly in the US and Canada, there were groups showing that there was quantum coherent electron energy transfer and light harvesting, although admittedly the first experiments of that were all done at near absolute zero, so it's not surprising that you see coherent effects in the very cold. That's kind of all the experiments that people are doing, but there's also been theory from 96 onwards. Famously, Luca Turin said the model you were taught probably in school for olfaction, it was the key and lock model, that there's a molecule that comes along and has a certain shape, there's a receptor in your nose, it has a kind of conjugate shape, and those two lock together, and that's how you get smell. And the only problem with that is it doesn't fit the evidence, in that you can deuterate this molecule, you can change it very slightly, change one of the isotopes of one of the atoms, it's got exactly the same shape, and now it smells radically different. Something that was smelling sweet can smell completely sour or bitter. And he said, but you can explain all of this if it's inelastic electron tunneling. That was theory, very controversial, referees hated it, great trouble publishing it. He ended up starting a company on the basis of, if this is correct, I can make molecules more efficiently than normal, and there's perfume companies typically go through, say, 100,000 molecules before they get one that they like. He dropped that by two orders of, or three orders of magnitude, down to about one in a thousand. So he has a successful business making sense for various things. And there's a lot more recent experimental work backing that up as well. There was also a proposal that bird navigation is again a quantum coherent effect to do with entanglement. There's been theory and experiment on that. And then most recently, and this is fairly controversial as well, that there's quantum coherent transport in ion channels. All right, why are we interested in this? Well, one of the reasons is...
Well, can you maybe comment, there's also a whole field of studies that claim that photosynthesis is also an initial quantum coherence.
So that was this reference here. There is a lot happening in that, and very quickly, and in particular the coherence that people see may have been due to the fact that the samples were very cold, may have been due to the fact that the people were doing the sampling with coherent laser light. And Aggie, who's sitting in the audience, I think, did you not publish on this?
Yeah.
So I know you have an opinion. Come and speak up now.
No.
Forever hold your peace. Okay. And certainly I think that a lot of the claims that were initially made were overclaims. I think that's a fair thing to say, yeah. But it has got people now thinking about exactly what do we mean when we say quantum coherent in this system? What is it a function of? Is it a function of the light that we're using to do the measurement? What happens naturally at warm, wet temperatures? And the whole slide is just to show you that people have been thinking about it for a while. There's certainly some effects that seem to be in normal operation with normal kind of operating parameters of the organism. There are quantum coherent effects.
So, but you talk about quantum coherence in the dynamics or in the states? Because if it is in the states, it comes back to, you know, the Schrödinger. I mean, if you have an aromatic molecule, you have sp3 hybridization. This is quantum coherence.
That's right, and that's not surprising. But in the dynamics, would be surprising. And this top one, this photo isomerization, that's certainly a coherent dynamic effect.
So it means that it's some unitary evolution.
It seems to be
timescale.
Yeah, and it's unitary. And it's not at all clear that that should be easily done. In that normally in our labs to get a quantum unitary evolution, we go to a lot of trouble to kind of exclude the rest of the universe. We certainly tend to do it cold or clean, low noise environments, and we certainly don't do it wet. And so the fact that it's happening in these warm, wet systems is really intriguing. And so it led to people playing with things like this last one. Yep.
Besides the fact that there is or not, it's also discussed if it's useful for something or just...
Okay, so yeah. So this is the thing. If there is a lesson to learn from biology, we'd rather know it now than kind of discover it down the track. And I'll get to that when I talk about simulation. So it might be the fact that there are some quantum coherent phenomena, dynamic phenomena, that you can do cheaply with a warm wet system. To take the Haber process. Okay. So fixing nitrogen, making nitrogen for agriculture. At the moment, it's still a really energy intensive process, right? When we do it, when humanity does it, it needs high temperatures and exotic catalysts, and it's just expensive and uses a lot of energy. But organisms do it really, really cheaply, really efficiently. So we still haven't quite learned how they're doing it. Now, I'm not suggesting that's a quantum process, although it might be. But there are things where we know there's quantum coherent things going on, and we don't know how they work. And we can't answer really simple questions. So transport, the idea that you're moving some exciton around a system. Normally people think that noise kills transport. So, you know, if I start my excitation here in some system, then after some steps it's spread out ballistically, and I'm kind of used to that. That's the quantum warp, by the way. If I add some noise, I get dephasing, and I can get kind of diffusive looking behavior. And if I have a lot of noise, then I kind of get Zeno effect, and I get localized. And so the thought, certainly 10 years ago, is that noise was a bad thing, that noise doesn't help if you're trying to move energy around a system. And then some work was done by Planio and Helwelga and Ravenfrost and colleagues, and they said, look, start with some tight binding Hamiltonian, describing some network, and we're going to have two kinds of loss in the network. I'm going to put an excitation to the network. I'm going to have good loss, which it goes across to some trap, and that might represent, you know, photosynthesis, and that might be the thing that makes the electron. And I'm going to have bad loss, which is anything else in the network. And then I can add dephasing, and eventually, you know, as you run it with time, either all the excitons are either trapped or they're lost.
So you say that the good loss is a local loss?
Yeah, it's a loss at one identified site. And what you want is the efficiency of how often do you see a good loss to a bad loss. And they said, look, you know, noise can enhance this efficiency. So take three two-level systems. I might put my energy into this system. I want to move it over to this system. That's the trapping system. But in between them to tune. And so that's going to be very inefficient. But if I add noise, that means more often I'm going to be tuned and I can get a kind of increase in the efficiency. So as you change the dephasing, the transport efficiency can peak at some value. Why have a good loss or a bad loss? This is a chlorosome that exists in a kind of purple bacteria. The light comes in, gets absorbed, it goes through something called the Fenner-Matthews-Olsen complex, which is basically a network, and then it goes down to the reaction center and makes the electron which you need to drive life. The biology on this is a rapidly moving target, so when I first put the slide together, the Fenner-Matthews-Olsen complex was thought to have basically seven sites. More recent research suggests there's eight sites, and that was before I hopped in the plane. There might be nine by now, I don't know. But it's some network.
Is quantum coherence preserved in such a network?
Now, that's the question.
Well,
that's...
for example, if you will make a two-slit experiment going to such a network, what will you see?
That's the question that people are investigating. So it's known that 1 and 6 are attached to the antenna at the top, and 3 is attached to the reaction center, and it's exactly that question of how coherent is the transport through the network. It's a transport problem. We wanted to model it in the lab. Other people have done it. Again, this paper from New Journal of Physics, and they said there's this extremely broad range of dephasing where the efficiency will go up to near unity, which is what it's observed experimentally. These little purple bacteria that live at the bottom of the ocean are really, really good at harvesting light. If a single photon comes in and they grab it, they're going to turn it into an electron. So. And that's kind of interesting. That's over several orders of magnitude. That's quite flat. Now, there was a lot of criticism of this paper. So we didn't want to do that in the lab. We wanted to answer a really simple question. Could we see this kind of behavior in the lab in a really nicely controlled system? So we needed three things. We needed tuning, absorption, and noise. In our case, we used different index waveguides. And the difference between the refractive indices gives us an effective detuning between the two-level systems. Absorption, so that's the idea, is we have some waveguide here, and then we have a whole lot of closely spaced waveguides. And if the light is going into the board, And then if it tunnels across to this one, it's very likely to tunnel away rather than tunnel back. So it acts as a trap or a loss. And decoherence we used a trick where if you send in narrowband light, you get very coherent swapping back and forth. But if you send in broadband light, each individual frequency is coherently swapping back and forth, but the sum looks quite decoherent. I'm going to just jump to the answer there. So the system we set up was a four-site system. The three sites here, 1, 2, 3. 3 was the trap, and 4 was the detuned site. And just showing that detuning there, in fact, increased the efficiency with which light went into the trap. So with narrowband light, you would expect to see only 2/3 of the light go into the trap. With broadband light, which is the detuned light, you'd expect to see 4/5 go into the trap. And what we built in the lab was a series of waveguides like this. We put in light here. Again, this is all classical light. And yes, we saw the behavior we were expecting. Okay, so that's not terribly exciting in that you could have simulated that again. I'm going to skip this next bit because that was if we had a lot of students in the room.
Excuse me, may I ask a question?
Yep.
In the 70s, like 80s, there were some very popular papers by Harkin, Strobel, Preniker about such systems, about excitons, which are disturbed by external noise.
I'm not familiar with the paper, so I just can't answer.
I think that, I mean, is the paper where they derived the master equation with the Fermi?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, actually, I will do this because of the audience. So, what's a photon? I think for most people in the audience, the photon is something like this. You've got a Hamiltonian, bunch of quantized simple harmonic oscillators. The Fock states are photons, their eigenstates, the number operator. And so at some frequency, you have some occupation, and that's your photon mode. And you know about the operators, the annihilation and creation operators. I'm going to just take you through oscillators for a second. Let me have a real spring, mass mu, length L, spring constant K. And you can do this in your office, just grab a spring. And I'll attach a little mass to it, M, and start it oscillating at some frequency, mu sub P. The frequency of that is basically G on L with some modifications due to the fact that the spring has mass. But the other way that system can oscillate, of course, is if I just leave it not as a pendulum, I just leave it as a spring, and its mass can oscillate up and down. And that's, again, just K on M, where it's modified due to the mass. Those two oscillations can talk to each other. And in particular, if I make it such that the spring constant times the length is equal to 4G times the sum of the masses as shown, then I get a phase matching condition. And the spring frequency can be exactly twice the pendulum frequency. So what happens is, as soon as I take this system and I pull it away from the vertical and I let it go, immediately I start oscillating not only at the lower frequency, but at twice that frequency. So the thing starts bobbing up and down. And we call that mechanical second harmonic generation, and you can see there's no threshold for that. As soon as you're away from the vertical, this happens. So as soon as I hit it with some low frequency, I start generating higher frequency mechanical. Everyone clear with that? Yeah? I can do the opposite. I can sit there and oscillate it at 2 omega. And now something interesting happens. If I do relatively small driving, it just oscillates up and down at 2 omega, nothing interesting happens. But as I increase the driving, eventually I get to the point where I overcome the internal mechanical losses in the spring, and then I get spontaneous symmetry breaking, and the thing picks a direction and starts swinging back and forth like a pendulum. Okay? It's a really fun demonstration to do with students. That's mechanical parametric oscillation, and that has a threshold, okay? Because you have to overcome the mechanical losses. Now, this is true for any set of oscillators. So if it's true for springs, it's going to be true for light. And that's how we make our photons. So what we do with photons is we come in with a high-frequency beam of light through a nonlinear crystal, and if you pump it hard enough, well, okay, let's talk it through. So first I need the pump frequency to be equal to the sum of the signal and idler frequencies, the lower frequencies. I also need to conserve momentum, taking into account the crystal as well. If I pump it above that threshold, then I get a pair of twin bright beams. So that's equivalent to really moving the spring up and down so it starts picking a direction. And that's called optical parametric oscillation. If I pump it below threshold, classically nothing happens. Classically what happens with spring is it just sits there going up and down. But quantum mechanically, I get pairs of single photons. And that's how we make it. It's called spontaneous parametric gain conversion. And in the lab, that's the best, most widely used currently source of single photons. It's got problems. What it actually makes is the wave function is there's some probability of generating a pair of photons, some smaller probability of two pair of photons, three pairs. And notice that term, that eta squared. So as long as eta is less than one, which it is, of course, that trails away. And in fact, eta is a whole lot less than one. And the way that you tune it in the lab is you pick the right crystal with the right properties, the right temperature, the right orientation. It's a function of pump power. In the early days of these crystals, you had to worry about humidity, so it would be easier doing the experiment here in Santa Barbara than it would be in Florida because the crystal would change its properties.
Andrew,
yep.
What determines the threshold?
So the threshold is given by the losses. So if I had a cavity, which meant that I could build up a really large field,
Is this a spontaneous parametric?
This is spontaneous.
That's
right. So the original one was oscillated, the next one's spontaneous. But the threshold is given by the losses.
There is no threshold.
There's a huge threshold. So what happens is I'm operating here well below threshold. Okay? If I had a truly lossless system, then I would never be in the parametric down conversion. I would just instantly go into oscillation. So it's always given by the losses. But of course, you can't avoid loss. So if this detector clicks and says I have one photon, then I know in the other mode, with some high probability, I have one photon. That probability is not one because there's a chance that I had two photons, and I'll have small noise terms. We know really well what the output of these modes look like, so this is just tuning the crystal back and forth and counting with a single photon counting camera. And over a period of about a decade, 12 years, it came up 7 orders of magnitude in brightness as we got better at making these systems. And the only reason we stopped making them brighter, in fact, they got so bright that the detector started to blow up. So for people who haven't done any optoelectronics, they all work on smoke, and when you let the smoke out, it doesn't work anymore. Okay, so if I'm going to use a photon as a qubit in an information system, I can skip this, I think. Okay, so that's just where we get our photons from. Okay, so let's go to photonic quantum simulators. So when Feynman wrote his paper in 82, I've talked to older physicists about this, and did people know about it? Yes. Was it discussed? Yes. Didn't much happen? No, not really. And for about 15 years, it was rarely cited. And that all changed with Seth Lloyd's paper in 96 in Science. And he said, you know what? Feynman was right. Feynman was basically guessing and saying perhaps something interesting will happen. And he said, furthermore, he said it's a simulator. It was a digital model, not an emulator. And he said, look, he gave a recipe for taking any initial wave function, digitizing it into a number of qubits, number of two-level quantum systems, sending it through some unitary operation, and the output wave function is to arbitrarily good approximation, the answer that you're trying to get. But you get it efficiently. So polynomial with the number of particles, not exponential with the number of particles. So I read that paper in 96, I got really excited, thought, oh, wonderful, we can do an experiment. And it took another 10 years before we got a recipe for that. These two guys here, Lanus Worogutsik, Peter Love and their colleagues, showed that they could take Lloyd's method and turn solving the eigenvalue problem into a phase estimation problem, which means quantum computers can do it. Because if you get nothing else from this talk, quantum computer is just a really good way of estimating a phase. So they gave a way to compute molecular energies and reaction dynamics and a whole bunch of things. There's a whole subfield there. There were some initial language problems. Chemists, go back to your little beakers and tubes, sweetie. This is a physics conference. Earlier, what do you study? One atom. How about you? Two. Sometimes three. Ooh, a biologist. We did an experiment where we took a little, this is the down conversion source I talked about before. We took two photons, put it through a toy quantum computer. It's a 2-qubit quantum computer. But we could run the algorithm up to 47 bits of accuracy. And even by the time we ran it out to 20 bits of accuracy, these are all, this is not calculation, this is measured data from the computer. Here's a data point. It agreed with this black line, which is a 50-bit calculation done by MATLAB. So a 20-bit calculation done on a 2-qubit quantum computer was agreeing to 6 parts in a million. This is a micro-heart tree. A heart tree is a unit of energy that chemists use because they don't know what a joule is. And it agrees to chemical precision. That was in 2010. A year later, colleagues of ours, Philip Alter's group in Vienna, did a 4-particle molecule. It was actually a spin system. And there, you'll notice they got 7 data points, not one of which lies on the line with an error. So why the difference? Is it that they're bad experimentalists? No, they're really good experimentalists. The difference is, as you go from 2 photons to 4 photons, I said before, the photon source that we use has these higher order terms. These higher order terms add an awful amount of noise. They're a real problem. So we're not going to make any progress in quantum chemistry using the current photon sources. Our theory colleagues have worked out everything we need to do, how to break up the Hamiltonian. There's a salami technique. Every operator you would want to do in chemistry, they've got a quantum circuit ready to build. And for about 4 years, I've been saying in 5 years, we'll see this done in a different architecture. And in fact, the slide's now out of date. Colleagues at Innsbruck have now done the first proper quantum chemistry, no shortcuts, using ions. And they can now make 20 entangled ions in a string where they've got full control, and they can do algorithms with them. In fact, they've got 50 ions in a string, but they can't show they're entangled because it gets really hard. It's a really non-trivial question, if I've got 50 entangled systems, to say what's an unambiguous marker of the entanglement and how do I qualify and characterize that. Tomography certainly can't use. So that's been done. But I'm here talking about photons, so, you know, is that over for photons? No, I'm going to take a break now. I suspect many of you know this better than me. If you go talk to a computer scientist and you try and get their picture of how they see the world, they kind of break classical computing up into soluble and insoluble problems. And they further break the soluble problems up into easy and hard problems. And the hard ones are things like factoring and traveling salesman. And from the point of view of a computer scientist, what's the blue circle? This is what a quantum computer does, is it makes some hard problems easy. That's it. It doesn't solve all hard problems. It certainly doesn't solve the insoluble ones. The factoring one is well known, the idea that if I give you a large composite number and ask you for its constituent primes, that's hard to do. It's the basis of most of the current internet security. Just the fact that it's crackable means for about the last half a decade, people have been thinking about, you know, elliptic algorithms and things that aren't known to have quantum computable solutions. And in fact, now some businesses have started moving to those. So is that a reason to be interested in quantum computing? Not really. No. I don't really care about that. But Scott Aronson at MIT pointed out that just the fact that Shor's factoring algorithm exists means one of three things must be true. So I call this Aronson's trilemma. It's in his PhD thesis. Extraordinary guy. The first thing that must be true, or might be true, is that the extended Church-Turing thesis is wrong. The Church-Turing thesis, as you know, is all computational problems are efficiently solvable by realistic physical devices, are efficiently solvable by a probabilistic Turing machine. Now, I'm not, as an experimental physicist, terribly worried by that being wrong. But Michael Nielsen pointed out that it plays in computer science the same role that Galileo and Newton's work played in physics. It put things onto a computable basis. It made it a science. If you talk to computer scientists my age or older, they tend to say, in fact, there's nothing wrong. And famously, Gil Kalai, in Israel, believes there is nothing wrong with the extended church Turing thesis. And he might be right. It might be fine, in which case then maybe the problem is this realistic physical devices. Maybe quantum mechanics is wrong. That'd be really interesting if it was wrong. It seems unlikely, but Paul Davies published a paper a few years ago that said...
What should then quantum mechanics be wrong?
Well, so maybe the problem is, if this thesis is right, the Church-Turing thesis is right, all computational problems are efficiently solvable by realistic physical devices. Maybe quantum mechanics breaks down for a sufficiently large physical device. So Paul Davies has published a paper where he said a 399-qubit quantum computer will work, but a 400-qubit quantum computer won't work because it exceeds the amount of information that can be held, something to do with the holographic principle, something to do with black holes. I don't understand it at all. But as an experimentalist, I love the idea that if I had a working 399-qubit quantum computer and I added one more qubit and it stopped working, that it's the universe's fault. That's really cool. It's normally my fault. So the only way to find out if there's something wrong with quantum mechanics is to try and build bigger and bigger quantum computers and see if they start breaking down. Right? Now, I don't think that's the case, but who knows, right? There's a third possibility, of course. Maybe quantum mechanics is fine, and it's just that there is a fast classical factoring algorithm, and that we haven't found it because we haven't been sufficiently clever. And that seems, you might think, well, no one really believes that, but some serious people do. Peter Sarnak, who's editor of Acta Mathematica, said in conversation with a colleague of mine, I love Shor's algorithm because it proves to me that a fast classical factoring algorithm must exist. So my colleague immediately followed up with, oh, what's your insight? He said, oh, I don't have one. It just means one must exist. Okay. Quantum chemists are the same. There was an H chemistry paper this year, Gus Kusiria, who's one of the leading quantum chemists. I believe there's a polynomial cost answer to the strong correlation problem. The strong correlation problem is what chemists call entanglement. We just haven't found it yet. So lots of people think that, in fact, there's no need for quantum computers, there's no problem with the Church-Turing thesis, there's just some algorithm that exists out there that we haven't found. Maybe they're right.
Well, for instance, in the case of electronic systems, I mean, the density functional theory, where you have a wave function, 10 to the 23 electrons, and you can characterize the ground state with just a function of three variables, this is a notable example of exact result.
That's right.
But it needs a fairly special set of conditions. It's a rare achievement.
That's right.
But I don't understand something. In computer science, they classify the problems by hardness.
Yes.
And then, so they claim that within the Church-Turing thesis, there is a number of steps that has to be taken to solve certain problems. I understood that what Shor's algorithm is basically a parallel way to do it, with a huge number of processes. Is it correct?
Not quite. So what Shor's algorithm does is it says, if it's correct, if Shor's algorithm exists, so that's the first thing. It's fine. Mathematically, you can check that it looks fine. If it's correct that I can actually build a machine that implements Shor's algorithm, then it means the Church-Turing thesis is wrong, the extended Church-Turing thesis, because it says that anything that you can do can be done basically in... let me get the exact wording. I always get this wrong. All computational problems that are efficiently solvable by realistically... physical devices are efficiently solvable by a probabilistic Turing machine. So if I could build a quantum computer, that's a realistic physical device, that solves Shor's algorithm, I can't do that with a probabilistic Turing machine. So if Shor's algorithm is right, and if I can build a machine that does it, this thesis is wrong. Now that doesn't bother me, because I'm an experimental physicist. Things are found wrong all the time. But for a lot of computer scientists, again, the older ones, that's a huge, huge issue. There is a way to save it, by the way, which is... Oh, yeah, now. So, by the way, this is... All three of those seem crazy to either computer scientists or, you know, physicists or chemists or mathematicians, but at least one of them must be true. We don't know which one it is yet, but at least one of them must be true, given that Shor's algorithm exists. So this is a great place for an experimentalist to come in, because we can build experiments to start testing those things. And it doesn't matter what we find out, someone's going to be badly upset. So that's great. That's all you're after.
Sorry, just ask for clarification on the extended Turing thesis.
Yes.
Am I supposed to read efficiently as meaning in polynomial time?
Yes. Right. Yes, pardon me. No, I should have said that. Efficiently means polynomial time. Well, there's some caveats around it, but not exponentially or worse. Mm-hmm. There's something called almost polynomially, which some people call efficient and some don't, and I don't want to go there because I don't have skin in that game. So the last half of this talk will be how we can experimentally start testing this trilemma. But before we get there, the other thing to talk about with quantum computers is there's now two kinds of quantum computer. There's universal quantum computers that are universal for so-called BQP problems. That's that complexity class. It's been known for more than a decade that you need entanglement to get the exponential advantage with those kind of machines, and that a small amount of entanglement is not enough. And in fact, more recently, it's known too much entanglement is a problem. The amount of entanglement you need appears to be almost a set and measure zero. It's a very special, special case. Too much entanglement, it won't work. Too little, it won't work. All of those proofs are for pure states. And of course, pure states are a collective delusion of theorists. There is no such, I stand here as an experimentalist and say to you all, there is no such thing as a pure state. I've never measured one. I've only ever measured mixed states, right? So you should think about mixed states when you think about the universe. There's these now so-called intermediate quantum computers. They're not universal in the BQP space, but they solve problems that are hard, that don't have any efficient, non-exponential classical solutions. The granddaddy of them all is something called DQC1. This is deterministic quantum computing with one pure qubit. So the idea is I take my working quantum computer that I bought at Walmart, and instead of putting in 100,000 pure qubits, I put in one pure qubit and 99,999 completely mixed qubits. Now that looks pointless, right? That looks like that's as close to noise as you can get. Surely you will only get noise out. But Manny Knill and Ray LaFlamme showed in this amazing paper back in 98 that you can solve problems efficiently with that machine. That was really counterintuitive at the time. In fact, there's a whole bunch of problems you can solve efficiently with such a machine. My favourite have been thinking the Jones polynomial and knot theory. It's not at all obvious that that should fall out. But if you think about the physics of that, there's something weird going on. So here's the machine. The idea is I've got one pure qubit, send it through a Hadamard to make it a superposition of 0 plus 1, and use that on the control of some controlled unitary that's going to operate on a whole bunch of perfectly mixed qubits. Send it through, throw the mixed qubits away, and do a measurement on that pure qubit. That looks like it should be useless. That is the engine of all of these DQC1 applications. We did it in the lab with two qubits because that's the easiest example. And the idea is if you can see fringes, you're solving something better than you can do, more efficiently than you can do classically. So with this qubit here, as I said, there's no such thing as pure. If it was, alpha would be 1, but it's close to 1. With the purest qubit we could make at that stage, we've got nice big fringes. As we made the qubit less and less pure, we could still see fringes. And in fact, you can make this qubit arbitrarily close to perfectly mixed and still be more efficient than any known classical algorithm. And at that stage, you should be really upset, because I said before you needed entanglement for a quantum computer. If all of these are mixed, and this is arbitrarily close to perfectly mixed, I'm epsilon away from a classical system, but I'm doing better. What's going on? There's a nice review article about that in Nature in 2011. There are now known to be, for more than pure state models, correlations that exist beyond entanglement. The best known of these is discord, but there's a bunch of them, and in fact Carl Caves has done a great job of clarifying how they all exist together. But the idea is if I use one of these quantum correlations, of which if I go to pure states they always collapse back to entanglement, I can still do powerful things. So I don't need entanglement, but I do need some kind of weird quantum correlation. That's the first model of an intermediate quantum computer. There's now a bunch. Mick Bremner and colleagues. Yep. Oh, sorry, I'm completely over time. Well, I didn't get anywhere near where I wanted to go. Let me just get to the punchline then. Boson sampling is a problem where you send a bunch of bosons through a linear network. I'm going to send n quanta, and I'm not going to say whether they're bosons or fermions, through some linear network, and I'm going to ask, how do they come out? Do they come out all in one mode, evenly distributed, somehow bunched? If I try and model that with a quantum computer, it turns out it's a bad problem to model. I end up for just, say, 10 photons into 100 modes, needing 400 qubits and 10 to the 246 gates. So it's not something I can easily model with a quantum computer. There is structure I can exploit, which is I know I'm going through unitary. So if I take the rows where I'm sending in the photons, and I take the columns where I'm going to measure, I get a submatrix, and that submatrix contains all the information about the problem. So for fermions, it's really straightforward. I send the fermions through such a network, and I can calculate the determinant of that matrix, and the problems in complexity class P, it's easy to do. For bosons, I have to calculate the determinant, the permanent of that matrix, so I just change all the minuses to pluses, which doesn't look like a big change. But because I can't use the nice symmetric method for solving it anymore, it blows up and scales as factorial, so n to the n in large n, and the problem is in complexity class sharp P. So the idea is, if I wanted to test the extended Church-Turing thesis, okay, first people got really excited when this came out and thought, oh, maybe we can use linear optical networks to calculate permanence and then solve sharp P or easier problems like NP complete. And it's true that the device outputs the permanent via the probability amplitude, but you measure the complex of that squared and you lose just enough information to lose the computational advantage, which is an interesting thing. You lose exactly enough that you no longer have the advantage. And even if you were just to sample from the output and just say, how often do I see, say, one photon in every output, that's a hard problem as well. So Aronson and Archipov came out in 2011 and said, if a classical computer can do the same thing in polynomial time that this machine here does, so this is not a universal quantum computer, it's a much easier device, then the polynomial hierarchy collapses, and that's my version of that. It would just make a lot of computer scientists really unhappy, and for details, go read quantum computing since Democritus. But a large-scale boson sampling experiment would be the strongest experimental evidence that the extended Church-Turing thesis is incorrect. So there's a bunch of groups around the world for the last 3 years who've been building experiments. We're building the photonics to try and do this. Gil Kalai, the computer scientist from Israel, has put a significant case of scotch bet on that no boson sampling experiment will work with 8 photons. Currently, we've got 6 photon ones working, so we're close, and we'll see if that will work or not. You may have an objection to this experiment in that you don't seem to be solving a significant physical problem, and it's a bit evocative of this. It's technically true that every object is an analog computer of itself. This machine is running a perfect simulation of cheese, and it's running it faster than any supercomputer. And the boson sampling circuit's a bit like that, right? I mean, it's not anything interesting. But if we can do the experiment with 8 or 10 photons into 60 or 100 modes, we are already getting to the point where we can get results from that faster than we can run on this laptop. By the time we get to 30 photons into, say, 900 modes, we're hitting supercomputer limits. And by the time we get to 40 photons, if you took everything on the planet, you couldn't calculate the answer in time, if it scales, if it works. So there's a whole experimental program testing that. I'm going to skip all the details of that and take us to the conclusions, which is photonic quantum simulators are capable of hard computational problems. This idea of taking a lot of bosons and sending them through a linear network, you can find problems that scale really badly. And the other thing that people have started thinking about is, okay, the boson sampling wasn't an interesting problem. It didn't scale beyond that. But people have started thinking about other problems and things like QCD and things like that, where perhaps this approach of just sampling is powerful. So this is beyond the normal paradigm of quantum computing that people have been thinking about. So So there's theory happening in that space. That's with experimentalists. Quantum photonic tools might be useful for your research. And so with that, thank you for your attention. And I hope you've sniffed out some interesting problems.
Questions?
So, can you tell me a little bit more about your six photon experiment? And what's the newest technological challenge that you...
I will pay you later for that question. The six photon experiment that people have done, if you use down conversion, every time you add two more photons, your rate takes an exponential hit. So if I want pairs of photons, I can get millions of those a second. If I want four photons at a time, I can get 1,000 a second. If I want eight photons at once, which is not unreasonable, that happens 10 times a year. So down conversion is not the way forward. And I would really like to do a 10-photon experiment and prove Gil-Kali wrong. So what people are doing at the moment is we're building these cavities that are either nanocavities or microcavities or cavities in photonic band gap materials. It's a whole lot of fabrication. The kind of tools, in fact, that Santa Barbara has are necessary. And the take-home message from that is that we are getting really good at getting light out of these cavities. And I just want to get to the nice... Okay, so this is a measurement of how often I see two photons. So with down conversion, I see two photons, 1-2% of the time. That's a huge problem. This dip here is... should be zero if I never see two photons. It's not quite zero, but it's close. It's quite close. So this is the kind of source we have in our lab at the moment. It's a true single photon source. If I zoom up, I can see it's still a little bit there. We're now multiplexing n single photons in the one spatial mode coming at different times into n single photons in different spatial modes at the same time, using switches, and we're building those switches. And again, this is how often we see two photons, and when we turn the switch on, bang, now we're seeing two photons most of the time instead of one photon. And we're doing the same with three and four photons. The other thing is we need the photons to be highly indistinguishable. The first generation of stuff we had, the photons, this photon and the next photon were 70% distinguishable. That's a problem. Jumping forward, we've just put a paper on the archive where we've got that from a quantum dot source up to 99.5% indistinguishable. So my hope is certainly within a few years we'll be running boson sampling experiments with non-trivial numbers of photons. And in terms of light-matter interaction, which I also didn't get to, you need this now to start bringing in large numbers of photons to associate through strong nonlinear interactions. And we're starting to get those as well. So in 3 years, we've come up something like 12 orders of magnitude and the strength of interactions we can get between light and matter.
So to make a bridge with the current program here, maybe.
Yeah.
So there is some interest in generating, let's say, with some artificial systems, states of light where you have 5 to 10 photons in a correlated state. That's what you...
Yeah. So, and the easiest way to do that is if you have some strong nonlinearity to do that.
No, but this should propagate. You want six generations.
Yeah, and then you put it into your network. So basically, as a...
Yep.
So you have, let's say, a device which creates a six-photon correlated state as output, then you send it to your...
That's right. And we can currently make six-photon correlated outputs with down conversion, but the count rate is dreadful. Once or twice an hour. And so no one really, there have been experiments done, but it's not the way forward. And certainly if I wanted 10 or 20, which is not an unreasonable number of quanta to want entangled together in some kind of network, the traditional methods won't work. We're going to have to use photon sources like I just talked about, and then some kind of matter-interacted mediation between the light. 2012, they were getting 10 to the minus 12 radians per photon. 2013, it went up to 10 to the minus 6 radians per photon. Or 10 to the minus 4. 2014, it went up to pi radians per photon. That's not quite there yet because the GD cycle is not 100%. But in 3 years, just the last 3 years, have just seen a significant shift in our ability to take separate photons and entangle them together.
I have a question. For quantum computers, so the fidelities, non-unitary, small errors, unitary can propagate very quickly if you increase the size.
If you don't have error correction. Yes.
Yeah, but now I don't know how much you can calculate. But have you tried to for very small boson sampling problem where you can do analytic calculation? Losses due to the mirrors or.
In fact,
preparation of the states. How critical is that for scalability issues?
Yeah. It turns out there's a threshold. Losses don't hurt you too much. What hurts you a lot more is distinguishability of the photons. But you could come in with 60% distinguishable photons into a boson sampling network, and still, for a smallish network, say 100 modes and 10 photons, still get out something that's hard to classically simulate. Because you get an incoherent mixture of the classical case where they're fully distinguishable and the non-classical case where they're fully indistinguishable. And as long as you can see some signal from that fully indistinguishable group, even if it's smaller, that's the bit that's classically hard to simulate. So it turns out boson sampling is incredibly forgiving, much more so than universal quantum computing. And it turns out all of those intermediate quantum computing problems are more forgiving. They're all intrinsically mixed state protocols. You can throw in an incredible amount of mixture and loss and perturbation, and you still get results that scale better up to some threshold, depending on how bad the loss is and how bad the nonlinearities are, than the best classical known algorithms. I'm not aware of a universal law yet. So there was a paper that came out in the archive 2 days ago by Carl Caves, Tim Ralph, and Saleh Rahimi Kashari, where they said for boson sampling with a fixed set of assumptions, here are thresholds that occur. So beyond this certain loss, don't do the experiment. Beyond this certain detuning, don't do this experiment. So people are starting to calculate those. But they're amazingly forgiving compared to universal quantum computing, where the thresholds are typically in the order of 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4%, or worse.
So from your answer, I get the impression it's easier to use one pillar with a little dot inside them, say, and make different pulses equal than build six of these pillars, each of them having a quantum dot.
And the reason is because the quantum dots and the pillars at the moment are self-assembled, which means that you're just relying on entropy to pull them together. They can vary. What we'd love is the ability to build up a quantum dot atom by atom. We don't do that yet. And because they're self-assembled, this dot puts out photons of a different frequency to this dot.
But I thought in most of the experiments, you actually deliberately choose a particular dot.
You choose a particular dot, but if I'm wanting to have six dots, then I'd have to have six dots with exactly the same spectrum, and that is really hard. And particularly since I then have to build a cavity around each of these dots, and they're occurring randomly on some substrate. Whereas if I have one dot that's really well characterized, and the breakthrough result came because we put electrical tuning on that dot. So we on our badly behaved dots, the 33rd photon that came out in the first photon only dropped in indistinguishability from 70 to 62%. On the new one, it dropped from 99.5% to 99 point something. So these are really good photon sources that just didn't exist even a year ago. So I guess in terms of things to take away, is the photonics technology is moving really rapidly. Unfortunately, it's getting into the regime of being really expensive. So there was a time when experimentalists could, for relatively cheap money, do really interesting experiments in this space. But as the fabrication becomes very expensive, so these things were made in a $500 million fabrication facility in France. That's an ex-telecom one. So that's happening, but that always happens with technological improvements. And there's a whole bunch of open theory problems as to what we can do with this. In particular, and I encourage people to go away and think about this, for this sampling approach, are there other problems that would fall open at this point? I've talked to a number of theorists who have got very excited and have gone off and are doing things. And then I guess the other take home is with this, again, the last 2-3 years, we've come up 12 orders of magnitude in interaction strength. So we don't yet have, there's no one lab in the world at the moment who's making 10 photons at a time entangled together at a rate of, you know, thousands a second, but they're probably will be 10 years from now. So think about what problems we could do with those. As I said, the ion trappers are already there. They have 50 ions entangled in a string, and they literally don't know what to do with them. Beautiful system, but too big. Hilbert space is huge, 2 to the 50. So.
Okay, Amazon. Thank you very much.
Thank you.